Hi, everybody, and welcome to the VFX Insiders Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Cedarleaf of Cedarleaf VFX. Today, we are going to be talking to Mr. Omar Nadir. Omar is a freelance visual effects data wrangler, and he has worked for companies such as Universal, Netflix, Amblin, and NBC, to name a few. So without any further delay, let's get on the phone with Omar. Hello, Omar.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I am very good. I am surviving coronavirus.
There you go. You're social distancing, I hope.
Yes. Hashtag social distancing. Hashtag coronavirus 2020.
Welcome to the world. Here we go. So this is as good a time as any to get people, that are typically working 16 hours a day. Now they're just waiting to get interviewed by a podcast person. So thank you. Thank you for taking the time that you have plenty of. It seems like everybody else does too. So,
like Corona has helped you.
It has. It really has. Now I'm just going to load all these up and just I'll have programming for the next 2 years. So it'll be great.
Yeah. So it's a success story of Corona.
There we go. Thank you, Corona. And by the way, this episode is brought to you by coronavirus. I don't know what else to lead into that without being, politically correct. So, well, let's dive into Omar, not this coronavirus bullshit. Let's talk about Omar. Obviously we always lead in that what got you in to visual effects and what is your current role right now in visual effects? So let's start with that.
All right. Well, it was kind of a long path. I've worked in the film industry now for, about 8 years. Mm-hmm. I was always into art when I was growing up. I used to draw, manga, comic books, and, I would hand draw and like color stuff with there's these really cool markers from Japan called the Copic sketch markers or Copic. I don't know exactly how you pronounce it, but I would buy a bunch of these Japanese. Yeah, there are these Japanese sketch markers. They're amazing. And so I would hand color and do stuff like that and just kind of make little comic books and stuff. And I really wanted to start working in film when I was like 4 years old. This is really where it stems from. I saw Jurassic Park for the first time, and like everybody else, you see Jurassic Park, it's like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And being four though and watching it, it was like I knew I was watching a movie. Mm-hmm. And but I what blew my mind was that was man-made, like that a human could create something so awesome. And so it's very inspirational to me because I was like, wow, people made that. And that's incredible. Like, it's just, that's like talent at the full capacity,
You know what? I think that's really cool because, I think we all have that if we were all honest, because I was looking back just thinking right when you were saying Jurassic Park. Now for me, it was Empire Strikes Back for Star Wars. Now I'm dating how old I am, but I'm not, that's all we'll go. But you're right. It was that movie was the one movie that, oh my gosh, I want to go join the resistance, man. I got to join. I got to help them out. I mean, here I was barely in high school at the time. So it's amazing that's a really neat question too, for future. Just what was the film that kind of really, really, got you into the path that you're in now? So Jurassic Park. That's great. Yeah. And that was a great movie. That was the big game back in the day too.
It was. And even in terms of visual effects, I believe it was, what was ILM, right? It was ILM. And it was a gamble. They had animatronics and they had the stop motion and they were toying with that. But then, they also had these computer guys that were kind of new. Mm-hmm. And it was new technology, and they showed some proof of concepts, and they saw the result, and they were like, man, we got to go digital with this. Yeah. So it was actually like a groundbreaking film on many many tiers. But yeah, you know, so going back to that, so I saw that, I really just knew I wanted to film in the area that I live in. It wasn't, it was kind of a pipe dream just because we didn't really have an industry here. It was, you know, growing up, it was like, you know, you're in Los Angeles or New York. That's where you go to make movies. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to do it.
Yeah. And people don't think out in the middle of the desert, the high desert of New Mexico, right?
Yeah, exactly. Which is, you know, where I'm, yeah, exactly. I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And it's like, yeah, no one would ever think that that stuff is filmed here. Although we did have some like Westerns back in the day, but you know,
yeah.
But nothing too crazy. But then that started to change as our legislation here changed, and similar to like how Georgia is, they we're not as busy as Georgia, obviously, but we did have a lot of tax incentives that came here, and so it became like kind of a popular filming destination. And you know, that was kind of like my wake up call, like, hey, this can actually be a reality. I can actually, you know, it's not a pipe dream anymore. I can actually do this. And, you know, my mom has always been supportive, although, you know, I'm sure she wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer or something.
Oh, wow. So, overrated.
Yeah,
overrated.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, so, yeah, I mean, she kind of wanted me to go along that path, but she never discouraged me you know, wanting to pursue that desire to work in the film industry. And,
right.
I landed a job as a PA, and I remember I showed her my first paycheck, and that was like, she was like, okay, cool. You know, all right, you can actually make money doing this. And so that was like a really important moment because I was able to prove my mother wrong and that I could actually make money off of, not necessarily my art, but off of, you know, my dream of working in movies, and I could actually make some money off of it.
Well, great. Well, what was that movie? Can you share with us? What was your first
so actually my first gig actually. So, we had just started, like our incentive, and it's kind of weird. So then I went to this, like this film training, crew training program. And when I got out, we had a new like Republican governor take office, and she actually took away the film incentive.
Damn it.
And so, yeah, so it sucked. So my friend, they filmed like Thor, the first Thor here, and they filmed like a lot of the first Avengers was done in Albuquerque, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And Thor as well. And so like parts of it anyway, I don't know how much. But he got a job as a PA on both films. And so right when I'm getting out, I'm excited. I'm like, yeah, he's working on, you know, this cool stuff. But the film incentive, like, you know, was shut down and production stopped coming in. So when I got out, getting a job was very hard. There was like everything cleared out. You know, they like, it was literally like overnight, they just left town, you know, wow. And it was like, oh man. Yeah. So everyone left. And Marvel was actually getting cozy here. I don't know how true this story is, but I did hear that, you know, there was interest at the time of Marvel maybe coming here. I don't know how true that is, but they ended up, you know, whatever transpired, they ended up going to Georgia. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it or not. But yeah, so I ended up getting a job on anything I could find pretty much. And so my first gig was actually... have you ever heard of the Nerdist channel?
The Nerdist channel? So like I have not.
Well, there's like not. Nerdist, and there's G4. Like it used to be a gaming network called G4. And okay. It had a guy, a host named Chris Harwick. And it had Olivia Munn. You know who Olivia Munn is?
No, I don't. I'm not. The ring doesn't, her name doesn't okay. Ring a bell. Okay.
It was but, like Aaron Rodgers, the quarterback for the yeah. Green Bay Packers. It was his former
oh
wife,
yeah think. Yeah okay yep
yeah so they had like a so she came they came from like this like gaming show. It was like a gaming network on cable that was like all about gaming, video games. Wow. All of the whole network was about gaming. It was called G4, and so they would talk everything games 24/7. It would have podcasts, it would have, you know, they would have live shows that looked like Good Morning America but for video games. And they would interview people, and they would show like cool playbacks of people's video game streams and all this stuff. Anyway, wow. It's a gaming network. And yeah, so Chris Hardwick was one of the hosts, and so was Olivia Munn. But anyway, so he started his own channel. He branched off from G4 Network and started something called the Nerdist Channel, mm-hmm. which was kind of along the same lines, but just, I think it like broadened the horizons and was like anything nerdy, like tech, you know, movies, TV shows, all that stuff. So it kind of started to bring in more stuff, I guess. But so he had some programming. Chris Hardwick had a show called Celebrity Bowling. And it was a reality. Yeah.
Celebrity drunk bowling. You have to be, you got to be drunk to bowl. I'm sorry for all those enthusiasts out there, but anyway, yes.
Yeah. Celebrity being bowling. Drunk really corrects. Yeah. It fixes your aim and it makes you aim right. You know, how I feel. Too,
relax, man. Relax. Yeah.
There you go. Man. I mean, I'm drunk right now.
There you go. All right, everybody. Yeah. Who knows what we're going to hear next?
but yeah, so he had the show Celebrity Bowling. And so that was actually my first PA job was, Breaking Bad, Albuquerque's famous because, you know, Breaking Bad is a show that was filmed and set here. And yeah. So
give us some context. What year is this now? What are we talking? This is.
I think this was like 2011.
2011. Okay.
It was like 2011. That was like my first gig, and gotcha. So it was like, it was like 2011, and so maybe I've been in the industry longer than that. I guess I don't know. Longer than 8 years. I don't know. It was late 2011.
Close enough.
Exactly. But. Yeah, it was late 2011, Celebrity Bowling. So they have Bryan Cranston's there. They have Aaron Paul, all the cast, and they're going to bowl, and it's for charity. And so they have to – it's like Team Breaking Bad versus Team Nerdist, and they're bowling against each other. And then, you know, and the proceeds go to charity. So it's a good-hearted, you know, good show.
Yeah, and, that's awesome. I'm going to have to go to YouTube. Yeah, I'm going to have to YouTube these. I'll have to put links to the show notes and all that. That sounds really cool.
Yeah. So I actually never saw the episode, so I was a PA on it. And so I had to get like Bryan Cranston's shoes for him, his bowling shoes, and Aaron Paul's. And Bryan Cranston was the nicest guy. It's my first gig. I go up to him, I'm like, here, Mr. Cranston, here are your shoes. And he's like, thank you so much. He says, thank you so much, man. And he puts his hand on my shoulder and he's like, what's your name? And I tell him, you know, my name's Omar. And he's like, thanks, Omar. You're doing a great job. And I was like, wow, cool.
Not bad.
Yeah.
That job recognition, you know, right off the bat. Appreciative. That's there you go. That's a good start to the career.
You know, Bryan Cranston to this day has been one of the most pleasant, you know, it was a brief interaction with him, but he's just such a pleasant guy and
that's awesome
from the guy, man. So
cool. Yeah.
Anyway, that was the first gig. And so I did a lot of PA stuff for that, political campaign commercials, whatever I could find, really, lottery commercials, Department of Transportation commercials. They would do like DUI commercials, DWI and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of did that run for a while. And then I did some like commercials for like Range Rover and Virgin Galactic. They have like a galactic division that's like like a space travel division. So I, you know, worked on a cross promotion with them and Range Rover, and did like Dick's Sporting Goods and stuff like that. I worked for like Vice Land for like as a PA on some like docu-series stuff. Mm-hmm. So I kind of did that for a while, and I finally made a name for myself. Film started to pick up because legislation decided to reinstate the film incentive because they realized that a lot of people, you know, lost work from it. So they realized,
so that's your transition into film and then visual effects at that point when that started to ramp back up.
So it started to ramp back up. I kind of was in a position where I had heard about this VFX, you know, jobs and that they existed, but I didn't really know what it involved really. Mm-hmm. Because on set VFX is when you hear VFX, you think like, oh yeah, you guys are going to be doing all the digital stuff.
You're
gonna
be doing, all know, the post
like, stuff. People generalize it and they're just like, oh yeah, yeah, you're going to be, you know, keying the green screens and you're going to be, you know, modeling in Maya and you're going to, you know, do some ZBrush stuff or whatever, you know? And yeah. So they hear it and they just automatically assume that it's a group of like three or four guys that are just, you know, in a cubicle doing magic, and then they crank out a whole movie. So it's very, very funny. So I think it's just so funny to hear that. But, you know, me, I didn't know what on-set VFX really was either. I mean, it's kind of a dark art that you have to be around it to really know what it is, I guess, because it's not really taught in schools.
Exactly,
you don't train in it.
And that's the whole kind of purpose of the podcast, is it's mainly, you know, again, selfishly, I guess, for my interest, but I think in talking about it, there's just a lot of things in the industry that are just, again, you kind of find out about it once you're in it. And you're right, there's not really a formal kind of schooling or a formal kind of apprenticeship. You just, you know, you just, okay, whatever the role is at the time, that, you know, the timing and the sequential and synchronicity of everything, that's kind of how everybody gets introduced. It's different for everybody, which is really neat.
You know, coming into film, and no matter what department you work in, I think that's, everyone has their own story and their own battle and their own way in. There's literally a million ways to skin the cat, and it's very interesting. But in terms of me, like I PA'd for a while, and then I started PA'ing on features, and so I did a few of those. I actually left the film industry because I thought I needed more schooling to get into like the on-set VFX stuff. Mm-hmm. So I went to a University of Art and Design in Santa Fe, and I went there for a year, but it was really expensive. And so I ended up like, you know, I was like, man, I don't know. I just wasn't learning as much as I thought I would be.
It was probably not really any practical things there, I would imagine.
No, it wasn't. And you know, what sucked about it is I was already, you know, by the time I went to that school, I was already, you know, 4 years into working in film. And I'm like in school with a bunch of kids that are just so egotistical, and because they're like, you know, they're like 17, 18, you know, they're just like 18 years old.
Well, they have,
you
know, all like, the answers. Yeah, I'm gonna be
the
arrogance of youth. I love it. I love it.
Oh, dude, they were so arrogant. And you'd see all these kids walking around like they knew everything. They knew the world. And they were like I don't mean to curse on your podcast, but everyone thought they were hot shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just, everyone thought they were the, you know, God's gift to everything. And it was funny because I was just sitting back looking at these kids and I was like, you know, like, you wouldn't last a day on a set, on like a real set. They'll eat you alive, man.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like it's, you know, and like, you know, just because they didn't have, it was hard going to school already having 4 years of experience.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even some of the instructors are talking theory, but they, you know, had never really worked on anything major.
Right.
And so like, you know, going to school, at least at that school, my resume was bigger than like a lot of my instructors even at that point.
Wow.
And so it was, you know, even if I was just, you know, working as a PA, but I, you know, as a PA, you're on set all the time, and I learned, you know, quite a bit. And I would recommend that if you have the chance, everybody should be a PA at least for a little while, I think, because it instilled values that I have today that I use even with what I'm doing now, which is I'm a data wrangler, visual effects data wrangler. But I use some of that stuff, you know, like I know what every department does. I'm well versed in all that stuff. So it's like, I know who I need to talk to. It taught me how to talk to certain people, you know, because, you know,
yeah, it's all about being relational. Yeah. It's just how do you contact and deal with people? Even getting back to your comment about Bryan Cranston. I mean, it's a lot, it's all about how you treat people and how it's relationship based. Because it's
absolutely,
it's huge of how important that is. So Omar, this is a great time for us to take a break. We're talking to Omar Nadir. We just got his background, which is pretty cool and to hear, and we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to hear what Omar does on a day-to-day as a data wrangler. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. We're back. We're talking with Omar Nadir, Albuquerque-based VFX data wrangler. Omar, welcome back.
Thank you.
And we are going to now find out about your current role as a VFX data wrangler. Everybody I know now is back from the break. They are now waiting to hear. So let's hear what it's all about, Omar. You are a data wrangler.
All right. I am a visual effects data wrangler on set. Data wrangling is an interesting thing. You know, we were earlier in the interview before the break, we were talking about this kind of like dark art of on-set visual effects stuff that you don't necessarily learn in school. And data wrangling is one of them. I spoke with a guy that used to work at Sony Imageworks. And I was talking to him, and it was weird. I went to a buddy of mine's house to return. I think I had a piece of camera gear of his or something. And I went to return some gear, and there's this guy in his garage, and they're building a really cool tactical looking gun. Nice. So I kind of walk in and I see these two guys building an assault rifle. I was like, oh, okay. Am I interrupting?
Yeah, wrong room.
Yeah, so they're like building an assault rifle, and it's like, it looks cool. I'm not a gun guy, but it looked cool. But so my friend introduces me to the guy. He's like, yeah, you know, he used to work at Sony Imageworks, and he's like he does like freelance VFX supervisor jobs now. And so I was talking to him about, you know, data wrangling, and he was interested in it too, because, you know, he made me aware that it is like a dark art. Like, people, it's not taught, and there's really not a lot of information on it. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of weird.
Yeah,
I look at me, and yeah, I started as a, you know, when I finally got into visual effects, it took me 3 attempts. And on my 3rd attempt, I became a VFX PA. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of grandfathered in, you know. The data wrangler was really cool. His name is Paul Stevens, really good guy, really good friend of mine. He's no longer with us, but, you know, he was a phenomenal guy though. And, I really owe a lot to him. And, but he kind of taught me, like, you know, like, I had to do all this like stuff that I didn't even know was involved in visual effects. You know, like, you're getting lenses, you have to, you know, grid lenses, you have to get all the lens information for each shot. You know, what camera is being used, what's the height, what's the tilt, what's their focus like. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of different things that you just, you know, you don't necessarily, going in, you don't think that VFX requires any of this stuff, and then you realize, wow, it uses a lot. I mean, all the camera data is applicable, because it's, you know, I mean, those are the plates you're being dealt. It's all from a camera, you know.
Well, were you familiar with photography at all, or cameras? And before, did you have any kind of background in that, or was it just?
I did a lot of editing work and stuff like that. So I did have like a knowledge, but not. It definitely, the stuff that he taught me was a lot, you know, more extensive than what I was, you know, trained in. So, it was really cool. It was awesome to learn all the stuff. And I just kind of kept going with it. And, cause I liked it. And, so I would say, like, in terms of describing what a data wrangler is doing day to day, you're on set, you are constantly kind of glued to the camera department and acquiring the easiest way I can describe a data wrangler is like, you are a script supervisor for the visual effects department. Is a good way to look at it.
Okay.
Because you're in your database, you're writing down the scene description, you're writing down what's happening, you're writing down or typing, I should say, on your iPad. You know, you're documenting the whole scene. You're documenting where the cameras are. You're taking photography of where the cameras are. You're doing like reference photography of the layout, where the lights were. You are, every setup, you are documenting what is happening.
Wow.
On every setup. And so in a way, that's what a script supervisor does. The script supervisor is looking at the footage and watching playback and looking at the granted, they're looking for different things like continuity and you know, making sure the actor's doing the lines correctly, but they're always paying attention and keeping a log of what is happening,
right?
And per scene, per setup. And that's what we're doing, except we're doing it on a technical you know, on a technical end. Like, we know what lens they're on, we know what f-stop they're on, we know what their color temperature is, we know, you know, what their ISO is like, if they changed it. We know if how deep their focus is. And that's for every camera. So we're literally just documenting everything for every setup that involves visual effects.
Wow. And just think about how that compounds with the visual effects heavy show. I mean, I know the one that we just got off of, I guess we could say we worked together on Army of the Dead. I know, but I guess at this point we can't say delve too much, but I mean, how many shots did that have? I mean, that particular show, I think everybody was on set every day for 12 to 16 hours a day. It was like my gosh. So I guess it was
a lot.
I guess it was a lot. It varies though, right? I mean, it seems like everything's getting VFX heavy nowadays, but I'm sure there,
you know, it's very true. Like, I mean, it's funny. The show I just worked on, I was in Pittsburgh for 4 months. And so I just recently got back, like, you know, like a month ago, but, it was initially like a non-VFX, we call it a non-VFX show, meaning like, you know, it's not too heavy in the visual effects, but it does have moments where it's going to be heavy. But, you know, when you describe something as a non-VFX show, it's like, okay, we're going to have, you know, some paint out work or, you know, kind of like some like 2D monitor comps, 2D stuff. So they kind of like, it's stuff that's not so involved, I guess.
Right.
And so the show has a lot of that, but like when you typically describe like a show that's a VFX show, it's one that has, you know, just, you know, a bunch of set extensions, like the one that you and I worked on, and like, you know, a bunch of CG stuff going on all the time.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that's a VFX show. Whereas the one I just got off of was described as a non VFX show. But going in, what we realized is that a non VFX show can quickly turn into a VFX show.
Yes.
And it was on paper, it was written and it seemed like a non VFX show, but I cannot count the amount of times, like, we had to be on set all the time. And it was because, you know, the producers would always be like, oh, okay, we need this, or we should do this, or green screens would just fly in on the fly. And so we'd always have to be on our toes. Because it became a VFX show. And not like super, super crazy like the Army that we did, but
yeah,
it definitely was more of a VFX show than initially was anticipated.
Right. Right. Yeah. Sometimes that's a good or a bad thing. It just depends on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just.
Yeah. So it was cool, and it was a great show to work on, a great crew, and you know, I love the VFX team on it. We were a 3-person unit, but it was, you know, phenomenal.
Nice.
It was a 3-man crew, and we did our thing, and it was great. But yeah, you know, like going back to what you were saying, like a lot of the shows have just become VFX shows, you know, and have a need for it nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and then this could be a whole other conversation we can have, which I'd love to get to, you know, back on and continue conversations. I mean, I'm looking now, we're almost at our 30-minute mark, and we're just scratching the surface here, so. I think, it's just really interesting to see, people's perspective and just where the industry is going, because that can be a whole other podcast. Is, you know, what's the future of VFX and how things are evolving with technology and virtual productions. But again, that we don't want to go down that rabbit hole right now, but that's another Absolutely. That's another day. But
yeah.
So just it, I guess, you know, obviously with every job, there's always the good and the bad that we always try to get people to explain. Everybody loves the horror stories, and they also love the, you know, to hear about the positives and the, you know, what makes your job so great that you, you know, you really enjoy it, and what's the biggest challenge. So let's start with the challenge. What is the most difficult thing about being a data wrangler?
So being a data wrangler, what I think is the hardest and most challenging part about it is that we typically, you're a small crew. Like I said, we were a 3-man crew. So you got like your VFX producer, your supervisor, and yourself. And sometimes you'll have a PA, or if on a bigger show, sometimes you have a full on crew. But on a lot of stuff that I've worked on, it's usually pretty minimal. And that being said, you got usually the producers offsite somewhere, and your soup is supervisors at Village, Video Village, watching playback and you know, doing his job. With that being said, you are the only representative on set that's near camera. And if you've ever been on set, you know that it can be very, you know, it can be a hostile environment, and you have to have tough skin and you have to have a solid backbone. You're dealing with the camera department, and I'm not going to lie. They just, I don't know. It's, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Sometimes they're not the friendliest to visual effects people. Yes. And, I love camera guys. They're great, but you know, I've actually worked with two, VFX producers, and the reason they decided to go the producer route is because they wrangled and they realized it wasn't for them. Because of that, there's a hostility toward, you know, there's a hostility, and you kind of have to earn people's respect.
Yeah.
And you have to have a solid backbone, and you have to have tough skin. And going back to what I said earlier in the interview, I said, I think everyone should be a PA in their life for a little while, because what I learned as a PA enabled me to be a good data wrangler, because I was already accustomed to it. So my skin is already thick. So it's like, you know, I'm like an armadillo.
Well, I think it's also, you know, again, how people's temperaments, because, you know, obviously some people, when somebody gets in your face, you know, people are going to just bow up and just retaliate, you know, kind of the fight or flight kind of mentality. Right. Whereas if you just, like you say, you hold yourself together and you just understand it, hey, we're making movies. We're not out, you know, solving the coronavirus. We're making entertainment, and you just kind of keep that perspective. And then you're right. I think if you do keep that kind of level head, people will say, "Oh yeah, that guy's he doesn't react. He's a level headed guy. He gets it." So, but
exactly, you got to keep your cool and just kind of like just. You know, you're just dealing with on set. Typically, you're dealing with, you know, people that there's a lot of egos. There's, you know, stress. You're in a environment that, you know, you're working. You're at work more than you're at home with your family, and you know that's a typical. And you're tired, and a lot of various factors that factor into it. But you know, at the end of the day, you're dealing with people that are tired. And you know, are at work and are focused and are intelligent and have their own opinions, and you have to just be able to work with a lot of different people with different perspectives and different temperaments, and you have to be able to thrive in that environment to sum it up. Exactly.
Well, and a lot of unknown too, because things don't ever go as planned typically. So everybody has to react. So
So
Omar, I hate to interrupt again. We're gonna have to take another break here. So we're gonna come back, and we're gonna find out the best part about Omar being a data wrangler. So we're gonna be right back after this break. Stay with us. Hi, everybody. We're back with Omar Nadir. We're talking with Omar about visual effects and data wrangling. Before the break, we were talking about the negative aspects. And Omar, I do apologize for the abrupt break there. We're just trying to keep things structured here. So before we go on to the wonderful side about VFX, data wrangling, was there anything else you wanted to finish up on the not so fun side of
data? Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, we kind of summed it up on that last one. It's just, you know, you kind of, you're on set, you're in a crew that's typically you're on your own, as a data wrangler anyway. You're kind of by yourself, and you kind of have to deal with everybody's temperament, and some people are nicer than others, and you know, you just kind of have to have a tough skin, and if you don't, that's okay. You know, you can thrive and you can learn, but you can always learn. But I have seen some people that just, you know, they realize that maybe wasn't, you know, the kind of work environment that they liked, and so they kind of branched off into a different side of visual effects. Yeah. You know, which is like coordinating or producing.
Like you said.
Producing and stuff like that. So, that's, you know, good. I've seen people do the branch just because it wasn't their cup of tea, but that's, you know.
There you go. Whatever. Just like everything, yeah, right?
Just all right, like everything, yes.
Let's swing the pendulum the other way now. So obviously, there's so much, I mean, obviously with the data wrangling, I can't imagine how you being a young artist and then coming into, you know, visual effects and data wrangling, and probably too with just technology, just how technology's changed, what it's been doing, even in the past, you know, few years, the leaps of technology. But so anyway, yeah, what do you love most about data wrangling?
So what I love most about it is that it's, you get to do cool stuff, man. I mean, you're on set, you have to take photographs of a bunch of different things, you know, like what we call photogrammetry, which is, you know, you're just getting a series of a gazillion photos as reference, so you can build, you know, meshes from them and stuff like that, or models. But one thing's really cool is that you just get to do cool stuff. Like, you know, on the last show I was on, like, I got to take a series of HDRIs and reference photography on top of a baseball stadium. And like, I was literally on top of, like, in a place where the public, no one really gets to access, like only maintenance gets to go up there.
No, that's cool.
And I was like, yeah. So I was like on top of this whole stadium. I could see the skyline of the whole city, and just, it was amazing. And, you know, it was really beautiful. And, you know, or even just, I got to step onto the baseball field and like this, you know, pro baseball team. And I'm like, you know, on the field, and it's like, man, you don't get to do stuff like that every day.
Yeah, so, that's true. Yeah. Not too many people do that. Yeah. That's great.
So it's like, you know, I got to, like, you know, go to this field, and you get to do that stuff too, because you get to scan all that stuff. And,
yeah, we get to, we're usually behind the scenes of everything. We're not in the front of the action. We're in the front of the action when we work with our supervisor, who we just worked with. I don't want to mention names, but he throws us in the fire, but we're usually in the background. But you're right. You get to really go to some really cool locations and see things that, you know, the general public doesn't get, you know, access to. So
cool. You just get like, it is, you get this like ticket, like, and I think just in film in general, like you get this ticket to go to cool places and see things that you would normally never see. And it's a really cool part of just working in film in general, but, being data wrangler, sometimes you get to, you know, go to these even more kind of crazy spots, and which I like. And sometimes it's funny, you know, you take it for granted. Even like, I remember I was on this this TV show called Midnight Texas, and on the finale, did you work on that?
Yeah, we did it. We did some scans for that. Yeah, that was
sweet.
Yeah, I never saw the show.
Did you do the pilot, or did you do that the
pilot
show?
The pilot. Yeah,
nice.
We worked on the pilot.
Well, you know, those scans, they rebuilt the whole town in the and Albuquerque studio, so that backlot town was built, you know, based on that. So I'm sure, like, you nice. They use your scans for maybe because that whole backlot was built to scale, you know, to mimic that street in Las Vegas, New Mexico.
There we go. Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
Small world. See, there we go. What else did we work on together? We don't even know.
Yeah. So I, man, that show, but it was funny on the season, on one of the last episodes, there's like a demon character. And so he's in full special effects makeup. He's got a demon suit on. He's, you know, he needs this special stool to sit down because this, you know, the way that the suit is constructed. And so he has this like special stool provided by the special effects team.
Yeah.
And it was funny. So it's late at night. It's like probably like 2 a.m, you know, we're getting close to wrap, but everyone's tired. And I remember sitting in one of the sets, it was called Home Cooking. It was like a restaurant in the show. And so usually the crew, when we weren't filming in there was a bunch of chairs in there. So the crew would all sit in Home Cooking.
Yeah.
And so we're sitting in Home Cooking and I look up, I'm like on my cell phone and I look up and I see this demon guy sitting across from me, this full on demon just texting on his cell phone.
It's like a surreal moment. Yeah.
It was. There's a demon sitting across from me on a special stool and then like on his cell phone. And then everybody around him is just on their cell phones. And I'm looking around and like this particular scene, like there was like a fight, like a, you know, with their special powers. So they like destroyed the whole street. There's cars like flipped upside down on fire and stuff.
Nice.
And we're all just sitting here, just hanging out. And I'm like, dude, there's a demon in front of me. There's cars on fire everywhere. And we're all just on our cell phones.
Yeah, you're taking it's like you're taking a lunch break. All right, guys, smoke break. You know, just
And
the world is just mayhem.
Yeah, it was a surreal moment. Like I was like, wow, we really do take this for granted. Like this is something that most people would never see in their life. And I'm sitting here right now and we're all just on our cell phones.
Yeah, exactly. Just waiting for, you know, just like you say, everybody's tired. They're waiting for, you know, rap and big hour martini, whatever. It's just like, it's just like, wow. Yeah. There's been many times that if somebody that was just randomly picked off the street and would come in and just be plopped into that environment, they would just be a disconnect. They go, wait a minute, what's going on here? Like you say, there's this demon over here. There's mayhem. There's cars on fire. And it's just like, these guys don't even care.
That's a neat little show.
That's a neat little, little YouTube short. That'd be kind of neat to do.
Yeah. Right. A little skit.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, so, no, it's funny though. So yeah, going back to it, that's the best part. And it's funny, sometimes we're so desensitized to it that we don't realize that, you know, there's really cool stuff in our day-to-day jobs and in film. And so I would say that's the best part, is that.
That's excellent. So, all right, well, let's see, we're swapping things around here and, but we usually want to just kind of end the interview with kind of advice to people, but you know, we've got some questions in here and I'm looking, you know, let's go ahead and do with that. Let's keep the order. Let's find what advice do you have for anybody? And then we'll finish off with kind of where you see yourself, what's Omar's plan. But, but for anybody out there that's listening, as far as wanting to be in visual effects, I mean, I know we're going to be talking to some PAs and we're going to talk to other folks that are, you know, all kind of advents and all our channels and opportunities and roles in VFX. But as coming from your perspective, what are some tips or what advice would you give someone that's looking to do something? I mean, you touched on it earlier, but
I think I'll, just to kind of like,
the thick, you know, skin.
Reiterate, I guess.
Yeah.
The thick skin, stuff like that. But even, you know, I would say learn about cameras, because that's just going to help you right off the bat. Because when you get into it, someone that has camera knowledge can have zero knowledge about visual effects, but when they're hiring, like, if you know about cameras, they're going to like you, because it's involved in the job. And so I think right off the bat, you don't have to be a guru. I wouldn't say you have to be like, you know, a camera guru or anything, but know what an f-stop is, know what a lens is, know how to, you know, how a camera functions. You know, kind of have a basic knowledge of resolution and stuff like that. And I think that is a good thing just to know, you know, just to have in your tool belt, you know, because I think people that are hiring, that's, you know, more of what they want to know, because visual effects is such a deep field that, you know, no one expects you to know everything. But if you know a little bit about cameras, there's a home for you in it.
So, yeah, true. Yeah, that's great advice. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, just obviously, you know, we touched on it earlier. It's just having a good attitude. It's just having, you know, understanding, you know, that, hey, people are people. And if you understand people, how they behave, and don't let them affect you. I mean, I think that's a lot. I see that in everybody I talk to. It's just having that personable and kind of even temperament that'll kind of really, you know, build a reputation that you're that kind of person. So, but, you know, like you say, everybody's different. Some people just cannot fit in that role or in that environment. And then they just, you know, move on to something different, which is great too. But that's the mystery of visual effects. It's just such an amazing industry with so many levels that,
it really is. And it's so deep, and it's like, you know, there's so many parts to it. It's like a full-on movie crew, except for post-production. Like, it's, you know, you got your lighters, you got your riggers, you got your, you know, and on set you have a rigging grip, you have rigging grips that are rigging stuff, you have on-set electricians, you have, you know, pretty much all that stuff, you have camera guys. Well, in post you have all of that too, except they just do it digitally. And so it's crazy. That's like a whole world of, it's a whole other movie crew.
Yeah, that's, and that's another thing too, where I'm really excited to be able to get some of the VFX people on the post side to really, because I know nothing about post. I mean, I don't know what your experience is, but it's just, you know, we just hand off most of our stuff and we never really see what happens until we see the movie. Kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But, that's a whole, again, another interesting aspect of visual effects that I don't know if there's a lot of people that understand what even happens on a day-to-day. It's just amazing what goes into a production. So
it's incredible, and it's, you know, it's amazing. And so I would say, you know, going back to the advice stuff, mm-hmm. I know one thing that helped me was that when I had gotten my first PA job, they were like, oh, well, you're interested in it though. And I had researched, you know, like some just basic pipeline stuff, how the pipeline kind of works, and you know, I just had an interest in it, and so I was able to at least talk to them about visual effects stuff. And I think that even having just an interest in it, like, I wasn't just joining it because I wanted to get out of being a PA, and I was doing it because I was genuinely interested in the field.
Right.
And that personally helped me, because maybe my experience wasn't as, you know, I knew a little bit about cameras, but not that much. And, you know, I was, you know, they kind of trained me in a lot of things, mm-hmm. but I think that my desire to want to learn, and just my interest in the field as a whole kind of helped me. And I think they saw that in me. And so
that's great. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. That is awesome. So I think that's you know, that'll resonate with the, you know, people who are listening. It'll resonate. I mean, it's just, if you go after what you want, and if you don't really know what's, you know, if it's not really, the job responsibilities aren't spelled out, you know, like in other jobs, other industries, like, hey, here's your role. This is what you're going to be doing on a day to day. But if you don't mind change and don't mind, you know, learning a lot and being open to learning, I think it's, it's great. It's a great field. So, okay. Well, the last question, and this is always, we're trying to see, again, we always, it's great to understand where people come from and how they got to where they are. And then especially the younger generation, that there's so much change and so much opportunity. What's your kind of dream job? Like, let's say the next 5 years, what are you pursuing, the path that you're wanting to pursue, or what's next for you? What's out there for Omar in the future?
You know, I've been asking myself this for a long time. You know, you just kind of, I have no idea. I'm literally like just like floating around, and I don't necessarily know. Like I know that, I mean, personally, I like directing. I direct music videos kind of like on the side. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy doing it. And I would love to do that personally. But in terms of VFX, like I like wrangling, but I also wouldn't mind like exploring maybe the you know, other options. I think in order to be a supervisor, I would like to learn obviously a lot more about the tech part of it. Like, yeah. I'm, you know, I have a little bit of knowledge in like Maya and stuff like that, but not nearly enough. Like I need to brush up on like some compositing type stuff, and maybe go kind of in depth with Nuke a little more, just to kind of understand more about it. Because like I would like that maybe, but also I wouldn't mind, you know, just dealing with numbers and doing the producer side, where you're just kind of reading the script and doing number crunching. Cause I don't mind doing that either. So in terms of, you know, am I living my dream job? Personally, my dream is to direct, and I would love to do that full time.
Yeah.
But I am in the field. And one thing I will say is, I am at least in the field that my dream job exists in.
There you go.
And well, I said. Have the, yeah, you know, like, I mean, I'm in
that way. You're open to,
and I actually,
yeah, you're open to whatever the universe throws at you. I think that's kind of the way I look at things too. It's just like, yeah, that's well put. Yeah. That's a very good statement, Omar. I'm going to have to steal that from you. So,
hey man, I charge $10. $10.
That's fair enough. I think I can afford that, so we can
make, yeah, okay. Business has been well.
We need to work on your rates. We need to work on your rates. Omar.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man. Well, that's another lesson. That's another podcast right there.
There we go. There we go.
But yeah, you know, in terms of the dream job and stuff, I think like, you know, I have, you're, as a wrangler, I'm on set all the time. I get to see directors interact with actors on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I get to see how things are filmed. And so you're kind of like have front row seats. You're kind of like, you know, granted you have your own job to focus on, but you do it long enough, you kind of start absorbing things.
Exactly.
And kind of like a language, even like you're just, you know, you're immersed in it. And because of that, you kind of pick up things. And I think like for me, I just shot like, we just did like 2 music videos last year. Actually, when we were working on Army, before we went to Atlantic City, I did 2 days. I did a 2-day music video shoot before we flew out.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And so like, I just barely released one today, but, yeah, anyway, so, I don't know if I can disclose that part about the flying there, but I don't know if that's too much.
I'm sure we can, we're fine there, but, well, no, I mean, I think this is great. I mean, I'd love to, obviously, Omar, we're going to have you back. And we're going to, you know, there's so much more to talk about, but it's just such a great opportunity for you to come on. I do appreciate your time. And, you know, those videos, can we, you know, obviously we want to put in the show notes. We're going to put, obviously we'll put a link to your email contact information or any type of reel you might have, or, you know, even the music videos, you know, we'd love to help promote that.
Oh man.
Anything that we can put on there that we can have our listeners take a look at? I myself, I'm going to go to the Nerdist channel if it's still out there. Just the name alone has intrigued me.
But, man. It's I haven't seen a lot of their stuff, but yeah, some of it was pretty funny. And in terms of me, you can go to omarnadir.com, and that's, you know, that's my website. So it's just my name.com, omarnadir.com. And I have my some of my current stuff on there. Some of it's unreleased. I haven't released it yet, but yeah, there's some stuff on there.
Well, excellent. So go check that out, everybody. And then also we'll have links in the show notes, so you can check that out after the show. And other than that, Omar, thank you again so much for taking the time out of your day. And stay healthy and stay distanced. As what is it, 6 feet? 6 feet from everybody now?
Yeah.
So you got to, before martial law comes down, we don't want anybody, you know, come to bring the hammer down on us. So, but
yeah, social distancing.
Here we go. So Omar, you take care, and thanks again so much for coming on the show. And I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Awesome. Sounds good, Scott. Thanks for having me.